Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you're one of our Patreon supporters, this is your extended ad-free version of the show. And thank you to our latest patron, Carl Jakeman. Great to have you on board, my friend, supporting us directly. You can join him and indeed all of our patrons. Get our full-length ad-free show, our exclusive weekly sister show, Extra Message, and a whole lot more. Can't promise massages, but I'm not ruling it out either by going to patreon.com/UK Tech. Now, in this episode, before we started recording, and this goes out to some of our patrons and anyone who listens live, I think we had one of our most extensive non-tech-based discussions ever.
It will be in the uncut, I guess, will it?
It's the version, yes. For anyone who gets our As Live version, it goes out in there. There is some petitioning for that section to go out as an extra message this week, so who knows?
I mean, I don't think it's focused enough to be an extra message. It's fine if people really want to listen to us talking for 27 minutes about things that are not related.
Very true. But if you have a view on fake meat, whether it's right or not to be a cannibal, and what sofa should be bought, then it's worth a listen. But I did want to cut to something briefly, Ian, that Stephen wrote in to ask. He said, I hope Ian is staying with the pod. Congratulations to Ian on the T3.com role, my fave magazine, by the way. I hope he's staying with the podcast. Now, this came up briefly last week because you were not here and also suddenly newly employed. Would you like to just confirm what I hypothesized, that you're not leaving the show but do have a very interesting new job?
Yes, I'm. In fact, if anything, I would say it puts me in a better position to do this show than previously, where I was in an unconnected industry. Now I'm back in tech, thank goodness, and lifestyle, and I am now more able to comment on these matters, as it will be my job to be informed upon them. So thank you very much, Stephen. That's extremely kind of you. I'm glad you like T3. Wonderful to hear those words. I'm extremely touched. And yes, I'm sticking around unless Nate fires me, which is possible.
It's very unlikely, though, mate. We didn't... but yeah, Ian is new editor of T3.com, which is very exciting for him. Brings us more stories to choose from, which is no bad thing, particularly during slow news weeks. But that hasn't been the case this week, and I think it's time that we don our speedos and jump into the pool of news. Facebook launched its dedicated news product in the UK this week, the first venture for the service outside the US, where it rolled out initially over a year ago. In short, it's a bit, I think, like Google News in that it shows headlines and snippets and stuff from news from a whole bunch of major and local outlets, which upon clicking them loads either the publication's website within the in-app browser, or if the publisher uses Facebook's instant articles tech, it'll load in Facebook's super fast reader view. Now, there are loads of reasons why this is significant, and it's worth us going through some of them in detail, I think, to inform the discussion. Firstly, though, Facebook obviously really wants to keep you reading news on its platform. So creating a competing service to something like Apple News or Google News, or even, I think, Twitter to a certain extent, is a way to do that. It's significant, I think, as well, that articles load within the Facebook app. They're not using an external web browser. In fact, it doesn't even work with browsers. It explicitly says you have to use the app. I assume because data collection, but that rules out publishers getting that data from their own apps, at least. But anyway, that's fair enough because it's convenient, and in most instances, Facebook still loading the articles it links to in a browser means that publishers are still able to display their ads and promote their subscription service and so on. So in many ways, it's a green tick for Facebook compared to ways it could have done this. But then there's some murkier stuff, in my opinion. A lot of Facebook's public relations push over the last week, and really over the last year or so since this has been a thing in other countries, well, the US, really, it's focused on the fact that it's going to pay publishers for using these news snippets, the headlines and summaries and things, which in Europe, and actually more recently Australia, is especially important given some of the regulatory scrutiny about how companies like Facebook and Google are scraping key details of news stories, like the headline and the lead and maybe a thumbnail, meaning that a lot of people don't need to visit those sites in order to get that that quick fix overview summary of news. And Facebook saying it's got publishers on its side by showing off that these publishers have actually signed up and in some instances are going to get paid for it too. Plus, they're still getting traffic to their websites. And all of this, as far as my research goes, is true. Facebook also, of course, is very, very keen to avoid, or rather maybe reduce, accusations that on one hand it's killing news outlets by hosting snippets of their content and then hosting the conversations about that content from their users and taking the lion's share of constantly shrinking advertising budgets from companies who previously may have bought ad spots on those news outlets who created the content in the first place. And on the other hand, it wants to avoid or reduce accusations that it's largely unchecked spreading of news and myths and disinformation contributes in no small part to election interference and other important world events. So I looked at the requirements for publishers who want to sign up to this, and any large outlet or even small outlet can sign up to this. And essentially the process begins with that outlet submitting their site for possible inclusion. They've got to prove that they're a real business. They've got to have existed for at least 90 days. And they've got to agree to comply to Facebook's attested standards and guidelines. In fact, it specifically states, I clipped this bit, the news page index does not accept applications from pages dedicated to individual journalists. Applicants' content should reflect the judgment of a multi-person editorial staff. So this, I think, is to make sure that only platforms that can at least prove that they have some level of credibility as a news gathering source can join this platform. You can't be an automated news scraper that's quickly launched to capitalize on a breaking news event and quickly spread some information very, very fast. This is designed away from that. And that's one of the ways that I think this approach is at least different from some of the ways that we've seen news on Facebook before. But then also I found a campaign magazine article from, I think it was from last year, might have been around October, or certainly last year anyway, that said Facebook News is curated in part by a team of human editors. Now, that's similar to how Apple operates its news app, the Apple News app for iPhone and iPad users and Macs and stuff, and that personalized is then further personalized based on user behavior so it can improve your interests in things that maybe human editors have approved and selected. So again, all of this broadly looking good as far as efforts go to say, look, we're helping, not harming. And it looks better to me in many ways than Google News. And there is an increased focus, apparently, on local news in Britain, which could help regional publications compete with nationals and internationals. And if this sounds like I'm uncharacteristically praising Facebook, don't worry, I still don't like it. In fact, I've always liked one of Alan Partridge's guides to life, Ian, which is, if I ever need advice, I ask a Baptist and then do the opposite. my version is less offensive, but it's essentially listen to what Mark Zuckerberg says and then assume the opposite better reflects reality.
I would agree with you there.
Which in this instance, and with Facebook's track record of launching things that excite desperate news outlets with promises of salvation only to get bored of it and pull the rug from under them, leads me to conclude that this is a moderately well-veiled attempt to curry favor with large publishers whose complaints would be loud enough to hold sway with angry regulators, but just enough to keep those regulators from looking into whether the company does more harm than good overall to smaller outlets, and who, per a story I see or saw in the Wall Street Journal last year, don't appear to be significant, if extant financial beneficiaries of any of these things on the first place. But on the plus side, Facebook's users will probably like the experience, and there's some money at least going from Facebook's bank to a news outlet's bank. Is that a bad thing these days? I guess not. But They are the facts, marginally coloured by my opinion. But Ian, I thought you might like to get a word in edgeways here.
No, that's fine. No, I'm only joking. I just thought after all that, it'd be quite funny if I said absolutely nothing on the subject. I obviously don't trust Facebook even in the slightest. I know that's probably slightly unfair of me, but then this is an opinion. It's not. I'm not pretending that I have all the facts on it. But I like you, Nate. I took myself off Facebook some time ago, and I've not really looked back. And it's partly this. It's it worries me greatly. Facebook is well known for harboring people with opinions that not only don't match my opinions, because obviously it's fine to have different opinions, but are also outright dangerous in a lot of ways. Anti-vaxxers particularly being a prescient example, I would say. And I'm sure the news operation will be fine. But it feels to me very much like Facebook is going to make a call on this. Obviously, like you said, it's a curated feed as Apple News is, which I think suggests to me that the smaller publications will struggle. It's going to be dominated, as my Apple News tends to be, and I don't have a Plus subscription, but it is dominated by, the tabloids and the broadsheet newspapers, and some high-end magazines you'll often see in there. So I don't see that Facebook necessarily is going to be that different. Now, I suppose if we were going to be positive about it, Facebook has a tremendous amount of data about you. There's no denying that. So if anyone is going to offer you a curated news feed that very not closely matches your interests, and let's be honest, if you let Facebook have its way with you and don't restrict it in any way, shape or form, it will know literally every news article you've ever read, because there will be a Facebook button on every news story, and that will be a way of tracking you back to Facebook. So realistically, that company probably knows every single news article you've ever read, every magazine feature you've looked at. So they probably are in a good position to give you a customized news feed. Whether or not you want to buy into that from a company that does know everything about you in that manner, I think might be worth thinking about. But it's not going to do anyone any harm if it provides good news. It might give a good boost to traffic. I don't know how much you feel this, Nate, but certainly in the, at T3, a lot of my time is spent thinking about how best to appear in Google News. We live and die based on whether or not Google decides to put us in a page. So we have to be cognizant of that. I'm sure it'd be a wonderful gift for every journalist in the country if they no longer have to give a single thought to, SEO and the optimization of their words in a way that pleases Google. But at the same time, I actually don't have huge complaints with Google. I think what it does is generally quite magnificent. It's quite hard to literally scour the internet as soon as everything is published and display it, and it does a pretty good job of that. And I would say I trust Google slightly more than Facebook in this regard. Like, I feel Google is better at presenting news from any site without any sort of interference. I don't particularly care that Facebook's doing this. I mean, I'd be fascinated to know what money's in it for publishers, because publishers are struggling.
Yes, and depending on where you source this, the numbers do vary. But some publishers, it's been reported, it can hit in several millions.
Right.
So there is potentially a lot of money here, but again, it's a drop in the ocean financially for a company like Facebook, which makes billions and billions of dollars a quarter, and could arguably probably pay more than it is doing, and a lot of publishers are desperate. So you've got to factor in that if a company with the significance of Facebook or Google or Apple or any company that has a platform comes to you and says, hey, how would you like some more money for something you're already doing? To many, that is a very difficult offer to turn down, even if long term you might be tying yourselves into something that harms you. But we don't know that that's the case here. From a local news perspective, there's potential for it to be beneficial if you are a local outlet, you know, a regional publication, which there are still many, but they are some of the hardest hit in the journalistic world by financial problems, then if this is a way of you getting more visibility and reaching people who are actually in your local area, and you're being paid for it and you're still getting the traffic, then in principle that could be a very good thing. And that's why I'm not wholesale dismissing this.
No.
It's just you have to, and I think it is wise for any big company, but Facebook in particular, and Google to almost the same extent, it's wise to assume that things are never as rosy mm-hmm. or as altruistic as the company wants you to believe, because there is so much at stake for them. And historically, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that this doesn't always go the right way for people who aren't Facebook.
No. And we used to, you know, like in the publishing industry, we used to see a lot of referral traffic from Facebook, people sharing articles, etc. That has taken what I would describe it as a dramatic drop off. I don't know why that is exactly. I don't know whether people are just not sharing stuff on Facebook anymore, or if I've just been in places where there haven't been a big enough Facebook following. But from my experience, I don't think Facebook has been pushing articles from groups. So say, for example, you know, like when I worked at the Mirror, if you published a story on the Mirror's Facebook page, if it was the main account, it would get a lot of traffic. If it was the tech one, it had fewer followers and it probably wouldn't get much benefit. But like, you have to sort of wonder how has that changed, because it has changed.
Well, one of the ways that Facebook changed it is by explicitly saying, we are going to show less news in your feed and more stuff about your friends and family.
Yeah.
And a lot of publishers, I think I notably remember Slate, I think it was, publishing a chart that showed just how destructive that can be on referrals. But if you were a publisher, and I don't know if Slate was in this instance, if you were a publisher that had bought into Facebook's erstwhile promise to get your stories and content in front of more people, and then you changed your business model, or you redesigned your website, or you tied into Facebook's instant articles or whatever it was that you needed to do at the time in order to be a part of that, and then Facebook says, actually, you know what, we've had a change of heart, or we're struggling a bit with this spread of news, so we're just going to deprioritize news and we're going to put more friends and family in. Instantly, it's like when Google changes its algorithm. If you've gamed or worked with an SEO company to get the top spot for a referral to your business, and then Google changes the algorithm overnight, I mean, at least Facebook tells you it's going to do that. Facebook doesn't. Google doesn't. It just changes the algorithm, and suddenly all the world's marketeers are like, sugar plum fairies, what do we do now? But then obviously make a lot of money off telling people what to do then. But the point is, publishers tend to be the ones who suffer in the first instance.
Well, I will say this, Nate, actually, on the Google thing. It is interesting, and you can look at it a number of ways, but actually, Google's game, and I'm not someone who defends Google very often, it seems to be more about making sure that people struggle to game the system. It wants to find things that are good, that are legitimately good. And so the algorithm tweaks are supposed to be a way of managing that. So where, you know, it used to be that top 10 lists would go great guns on Google, I think that people started to game those and just turn them into lists of affiliate links, and that doesn't give the reader any value. So Google went, right, well, we'll tweak that. So that, you know, and then on the flip side, what I'm thinking about Facebook is I'm thinking they're going to run this for a while. It's going to cost them £1 billion, and they're going to go, wouldn't it be easier if we just got the publishers to pay to be on this platform, and then they can have the traffic and the ad revenue and the affiliate clicks and all that kind of stuff. But why would we provide this service for free? And then they'll do that. I could see it happening.
It hasn't happened, but it could happen. And I don't think it would surprise anyone if something like that happened. But
I think it's a good idea to give publishers money. Journalism is really struggling. It's not right that it's struggling. That, you know, we're trying to do a service for people. We're trying to make it so that people can make decisions on things. You know, is Brexit a good idea or is Brexit a bad idea? You know, is a vaccine a good thing or a bad thing? You know, that's the point of journalism. It's supposed to help people understand things that are too complicated for anyone to research themselves. And, of course, which TV to buy. But, you know, it's like, yes, we can't do that if there's no money and people aren't buying magazines and they aren't buying newspapers and they're not mostly subscribing to things online. So we do need money. And I think that, you know, if Facebook can do a good job of it, then it should be a good thing. And I will give them the credit they deserve in that regard.
It's definitely worth us saying, just for disclosure, even though it's obvious, that we're talking about this as two professional journalists who work for big outlets. So we are very aware of our inherent bias here, but also we're not talking about it from our employer's perspective.
No.
These are our own views.
And I believe that Future isn't on it, so therefore, yes.
And I have no idea if Bloomberg's on it. But it's kind of irrelevant because it doesn't matter where we write professionally, the opinions are going to be the same. But take that with a pinch of salt for what it is worth. If you have a view on this, if you've used this already in the UK and the US, let us know your experiences. Typically, this is the sort of thing that gets rolled out across Europe before too long. And I believe France and Germany, certainly Germany, Facebook is in conversations with publishers there to launch it. So expect it to come to your country before too long. And any opinions you have in the meantime, send them to hello@uktechshow.com. It's apparent, Ian, that the contactless spending limit on debit cards and credit cards in Britain is just not high enough. So the Financial Conduct Authority, our local regulator, is talking about raising it and not by a small amount. In fact, it's talking about more than doubling it to £100. And this is less than a year, in fact, after it raised it to £45 from 30 as a way of helping reduce the need for people to carry cash or type in pins during the pandemic. The BBC reported this. I mean, a lot of people reported this that I saw, but they included a quote from the Financial Conduct Authority that said, "It is important that payment regulation keeps pace with consumer and merchant expectations. Recognizing changing behavior in how people pay is part of a wider consultation. We will shortly be seeking views on amending our rules to allow for a possible increase in the contactless limit to £100. There was also a dissenting voice in this BBC story from a gentleman called Andrew Cregan, who is a payments policy advisor at the British Retail Consortium, who said, quote, "We have concerns about raising the contactless limit, with losses from incomplete contactless payments at self-checkouts currently costing retailers millions in lost revenue." So a couple of things to address here. My quick opinion before I turn to you, Ian, is that I'm not wholly in favour of this in the way that simply because I think it is too easy for people to have their card taken and used for bigger purchases that could have a more immediately negative impact on their bank balances if they are living hand to mouth and don't have a great deal of savings in a current account, even if that you're going to get your money back. Like, that could be quite difficult. Whereas doing something with Samsung Pay or Apple Pay or Google Pay, those limits are, I mean, in many instances, the limits are in the thousands. You can buy a laptop with a watch, for instance, but there is already a layer of biometric authentication there in that you have to use the thumbprint or facial ID on your device in order to make that contactless payment.
Well, not on the watch, you don't.
Well, you do, because you have to at least have the PIN put in.
Well,
when
yes,
you first put it on. But the point is, there's another layer of safety there which doesn't exist for contactless. But what is your view?
I think it's generally a good thing. I noticed when I was at Waitrose the other day, you can pay on Apple Pay up to £10,000 in Waitrose. Now, first of all, I'd like to know who spends £10,000 in Waitrose. That seems ludicrous.
Have you seen the price of avocado and hummus during the pandemic, Morris?
This is why the millennials are struggling to buy houses, isn't it? Because of all their smashed avocado toast, if we're to believe the national media. So yes, I think I generally think that upping the limit is a good convenience move. Obviously, like you, I have similar concerns in that, you know, if your card is stolen, then it can be used in that way. But also, this is like the last gasp for cards, surely, isn't it? I mean, it's so much easier to pay on a phone as a rule, and much more secure, and it just feels more convenient to me.
But there is a socioeconomic issue here, which is not everybody has a phone. Some people are elderly,
yep.
Or in other ways, ineligible somehow to use a phone. So there is a need for cards. But you are right that card usage is rapidly changing in the UK. Contactless actually accounts for just under half of all card transactions in the UK now, and that is with the limit being £45 per transaction, let alone what it would be if it went up to 100. But interestingly, I did see figures that the proportion of contactless payments has fallen slightly compared with pre-pandemic levels, largely because people aren't using them to buy £44.99 rounds of beer in pubs or on restaurants or public transport. But that number will almost certainly creep back up once people are actually able to go out. But even still, it's close to half of all payments in the UK are made with contactless cards.
I mean, what about if we're thinking about it the wrong way in terms of the future for cards? Like, why doesn't someone offer something that is like a digital card? I mean, we have seen it before. Like, Barclays had that awful BPay service that I think has gone away now, and there have been other people attempting to do essentially a card on something else. But like, you know, why not have something like a little digital card that you can use that's got Google Pay?
Well, because, mate, I think
you've
answered your own point. It's that those sorts of things require some kind of proprietary intervention, and people don't like that.
Well, not if it was Google Pay or Apple Pay.
But in that case, you are essentially already in some way going to have to be tied into a mobile ecosystem, in which case you've probably got a phone. I think the reason debit cards work is they are very convenient. They're incredibly cheap. Everyone knows how to use them. The alternative is a mobile phone, like having something in the middle. I
or
assume.
Or cash. The other alternative is cash. Because the people you're talking about.
Cash sucks.
Yes. But the people you're talking about, the people who don't have mobile phones that are capable or people who aren't interested. They may also be the people who operate largely on cash. So, you know, that is an alternative to payment with a card. And I think you could actually make the argument the same way. Like, someone could have their card stolen, but they could also have their cash stolen. So really, having a card, it's not much more of a risk than having cash. And at least a £100 cap is better than nothing, and also it is potentially recoverable if your card was stolen.
Well, let me pose that to you then, because if you were to have your card stolen and somebody takes it to a bank and you report it, you get your money back.
Yeah.
If you get mugged and someone steals your cash, you can't go to your bank and say, I was just mugged, can I have my £50 that you just gave me through the ATM back?
Yeah.
So cash is worse. Also, cash is really expensive. It's so ironic, isn't it? Cash is actually more expensive to handle and manage than not having cash.
And there's a pandemic on. So therefore, you know, cash brings with it some extra risks.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UKTech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
I think, Ian, it is time that we invite another member of the text message family of individuals to don their own Speedos and dive into the news pool with us. And while in there, splashing around like an artful fish, struggling for survival, let's listen to what's been happening in the wider world of tech with Tom Merritt this week.
This week on Daily Tech News Show, GameStonk, but also why the WWE found a new streaming home on Peacock. Annalie Newitz helps us understand what Pompeii can teach us about tech migrations, why Google killing off Tiltbrush might be a good thing this time, why the first Facebook oversight board decisions impressed Justin Robert Young, and robots to clean our sewers. All that and much more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Nice.
You see, no crossover.
No, I know.
Both shows, and you will not get crossover. They're complimentary.
I do. I mean, I wouldn't want to talk about GameStonk and the stonks, but, you know, it is fascinating watching it. Have you enjoyed seeing the stock go up and down in the last week on your fancy Bloomberg terminal?
I've just really enjoyed the use of the word stonk, because when I hear the word stonk, I think of the stonk song, the Red Nose Day song,
yes,
from 1990, Hail and Pace.
I will say that...
Or getting a stonk on, which in Britain has a very different connotation. Right, I think that's that'll do it for today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, patrons. We've had a super, super fun live chat room, as we always do every week, with what I would say are in the top percentile of our most attractive patrons. We've got Aaron, we've got Al, Andy, Charlotte, John, Camille, Luke, Nick, Pangolin Sandwich. Her name's Kate. I'm married to her. And Richard, all of whom are, you know, supporting us directly and being brilliant. And we thank you for it. And indeed, all of you for listening. And until next week, I think Ian's got a sofa to buy and I'm going to go and taste. Let's not talk about cannibalism again. That's in the long version of the show.
I think I'm just
going to go away.
I would like to buy a sofa, but what's more likely is I'm going to go downstairs, turn on my OLED TV and watch something. I watched all of the Hunger Games the other night.
I have absolutely no interest in that. Goodbye, everybody.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.